This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined right now by Gabriel Kuhn, who is the author of a book soon to be released by PM Press called Soccer Versus the State, Tackling Football and Radical Politics. It is a perfect fit for The People's Game, at least from its description from the PM Press catalog, even mentioning the phrase People's Game in relation to the history of soccer. And we'll be talking to Gabriel Kuhn about that in a little bit. But first, I want to ask him about himself and then his impressions on the 2010 World Cup tournament. And the reason I want to ask him about himself, because I see in the little about the author line here in the PM Press catalog, that you had a four-year semi-professional soccer career. So tell the listeners about your soccer career.
My soccer career. I would start with saying that until I was, I think, about 16 years old, sports was pretty much the only thing I was interested in. Then other things came, like punk rock and radical politics and whatnot, which did have an impact on my soccer career, too. But until 16, that was all I was interested in. And I grew up in the west of Austria, in the province of Tyrol. And so I think at the age of 14, I started to represent that province, and we would play tournaments all around Austria. And then I was picked up by what was at the time a second division team in Austria. I was very, very young, 15. So this was the first division in Austria at the time was fully professional, and the second division was semi-professional. And so I played for them for 4 years, which was a very interesting time, but it was also a time where, as I said before, I started to get interested in other things than sports, and particularly soccer. And I guess after those 4 years, certain contradictions became really strong, and I abandoned that soccer career for other things like traveling, for example, and doing more political work. And ever since then, though, I mean, the interest in the game itself hasn't really disappeared. So I try to stay connected in other ways, like playing pickup games and writing books about it, I guess.
What were those contradictions that you started to see? And I'll frame it in this respect, the question, because in the United States, and I played soccer at the college that I attended on my university's freshman team, I was invited back to try out for the varsity team for my sophomore year. But by that time, I felt I couldn't pursue my course of study and continue playing soccer, which took so much of my time every fall at the university right. I was attending. But one thing for sure is that my politics, which were very similar to my politics as they remained, which are in the American context on the very, very far left end of the political spectrum, mm-hmm. maybe even off the spectrum to the left, there were people on campus that I shared politics with, none of whom ever came anywhere close to the soccer team or any of the other major varsity sports. Was that apparent also in West Austria when you were playing?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. That was definitely one of the contradictions. I would say that for a lot of political activists at the time, being involved in competitive sports wasn't exactly something that you'd expect people to be because of the competitive character to begin with, but then also, I mean, especially in Western Austria, and I would say that's probably true for most of Europe. I mean, soccer culture is very much rooted in it's very patriarchal. From the locker rooms to the stands in the stadiums, you're always confronted with sexist, racist remarks. It might have changed a little bit over the last 20 years. That's a big discussion, but definitely when I was playing, that was a big problem. But to be honest, for me, the bigger problems actually had to do with management and sponsors. It just seemed that there were a lot of interests involved in, the specific club I was playing in, but in all the clubs and in the leagues, basically people being out there to make profits, using, the success of the team for political campaigns of conservative parties, and just on a personal level, dealing with those people who I just really, had, to be honest, not so much respect for. I think that was the most challenging part. All the other aspects that I mentioned, the kind of, tough guy locker room atmosphere, I felt that I could sort of deal with that. I mean, there was a way where you could resist that to a certain degree and challenge that. So that was a challenge, but that alone wouldn't have, made me stop playing. It was more the kind of bigger picture, I guess. And, I mean, admittedly, there were some personal reasons, too. Just as you said, you know, it took a lot of my time as well, and, you know, which I wanted to use for other things. But, yeah, I think that would kind of sum those problems up.
Yes, and as it says here also, you then went on to get a PhD in philosophy at the University of Innsbruck. I'll add about my experience, too, in college, that I had refined my soccer skills while living in Europe. In Italy specifically as a child. And when I went from my high school where I played and had a great amount of fun playing and then went to university, I felt on the East Coast school that I attended, they really weren't playing football so much as rugby. I mean, it was all very much like De Jong and Van Bommel from yesterday's match. And, you know, at the time I wanted to play like Socrates, the great Brazilian player, right. And they didn't really have any use for midfielders who did anything except tackle the opposing players,
win
the ball back.
I mean, as a European, you know, I shouldn't say much about U.S. soccer. And obviously, I mean, you know, there are great players. There's a lot of talent. My experience, I went to a university in the States for a year in Arizona, and I, you know, had an interest, of course, in the soccer team there. And to be perfectly honest, at that time, the quality wasn't all that. I don't know if it was rugby, but it was probably fairly close, to be honest.
I think it's improved dramatically. I was back in the mid-80s. It really had no relationship to the elegance that was played in around the world. And again, a little bit more like what we saw from the midfield from the Netherlands yesterday. So before we move on, and I know that the people who are tuning into this interview probably really want to get Gabriel Kuhn on to hear him talk about soccer and politics, radical politics and football, which has been so much the focus of the show. But one more detour through the 2010 World Cup. Obviously, you know a lot about football. What did you make of the 2010 World Cup? What do you make of Spain?
Let's start with Spain. I think, especially with the game yesterday, I don't know. You know, I guess it's what you'd call, honestly, always like it when teams win tournaments like that, who actually really win every single game. So, or at least, you know, don't lose any of the games. So in that sense, the Netherlands would have fit the picture. But no, I mean, Spain played well, and so that's all fine. The tournament overall, I think it was interesting. I mean, there was a lot of things that people have already discussed. I mean, something has to happen with the refereeing, something a long time ago. I think it's become more evident than ever than that is necessary. Then there are other aspects, like, you know, it's interesting that for some reason African national teams just can't seem to make that step from being serious contenders to actually, you know, advancing to the finals or even taking the cup. I think that's been pretty interesting. There was a lot of interesting stuff happening around the actual games. I mean, there were a lot of protests, strikes by workers who were involved in, you know, preparing the cup and you know, working as security. There wasn't a lot of coverage on that, but I thought that was a pretty interesting aspect. And, I mean, sports-wise overall, I thought it was entertaining. There were interesting teams. There were interesting games. A very weird ball, which led to a lot of interesting goals, too. So, no, I thought it was, for people who like to watch soccer, I thought it was entertaining.
I'm speaking with Gabriel Kuhn. He's the author of a book soon to be released by PM Press called Soccer Versus the State, Tackling Football and Radical Politics. So let's go straight on to the points of view and arguments that you put forward in this book. It says here that soccer, and this is clearly true, has turned into a multi-billion dollar industry. Professionalism and commercialization dominate its global image. Yet the game retains a rebellious side, maybe more so than any other sport co-opted by moneymakers and corrupt politicians. That final point, please explain how you see that, because this has been a big theme that we've spoken about here. In many respects, a lot of our focus has revolved around how soccer, football exists in Southern California and in the United States. But from the perspective of someone in Europe, explain your point.
The point is, I think, that traditionally, and this is difficult. I'm tempted to say, you know, traditionally soccer has been a working class game. That is partly true, and it's partly not true. It's not so much true in the sense that if you look at even the beginnings of soccer in Europe, very soon there were, you know, interests involved that didn't have anything to do with the working class, but with factory owners and others. But it was largely played by the working class, and also the audience has largely been working class. in that sense, I think, you know, that term, the people's game, relates to that. One aspect, of course, is that, you know, it's very easy to play soccer. You need a ball of sorts, and you can play it wherever. I mean, it's nice if you have, you know, a good pitch, but you can play it on the street or whatnot. So soccer has always been played on all sorts of levels, and that certainly continues. So I think what today is interesting and what I'm looking at is that, A, there really is some kind of what you might want to call a soccer underground culture,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, people, apart from the professional and commercialized game, organize their own tournaments, have their own clubs, you know, have networks. I mean, there are radical football teams traveling the world today because of those networks and, you know, play games in Palestine and Chiapas and other regions. So that is one phenomenon that I'm looking at. And the other one is that that's a factor in the book. Unfortunately, it's not a strong factor within the professional and commercial game, but it is a factor that remains because you have such a huge audience for soccer, obviously, and so many people are interested in it. It provides a platform where, you know, you can voice critical or draw attention to certain issues and voice critical opinions on certain, you know, political themes and questions that are being discussed. Now, admittedly, that doesn't happen all that much, but it happens there and there. So that's the other aspect of the book I'm looking at. It's basically, if you're already interested in the professional game, and there are lots of reasons why someone who would, you know, who likes soccer would be interested in it, where are those kind of radical, critical, progressive elements that you can relate to as a critical, progressive, radical soccer fan? So they're basically, I'm trying to cover those two aspects, the underground soccer culture, if you will, and the progressive radical elements within the professional game, which I think both tie back to this tradition of, if you will, the people's game.
In fact, I want to cite somebody who I think I'm amazed to say I've not mentioned on the people's game. My club side traditionally has been AS Roma. And a player on that side earlier this decade, Tommaso, organized two different efforts to protest U.S. wars. And I believe they were both in Afghanistan and Iraq. And this was a player, and he was a defender, and he rarely scored. But I remember seeing him once score on a game, pulled up his shirt, and there was a Stop Bombing Serbia message
right.
that was unveiled. And he organized against the bombing of Afghanistan shortly after September 11th, an international petition of players that Ronaldo signed on. And, of course, Francesco Totti was very much an ally of Tommaso's. But, again, that kind of thing is somewhat rare. And, of course, Diego Maradona, perhaps more famously, is involved this decade with some similar expressions. Of course, Maradona is often a contradictory figure. But you're quite correct, and certainly there was an element that I was wishing to see Maradona's team succeed for the hope that there would be such expressions in front of the largest audience in the world, which, of course, was gathered to watch yesterday's game. It says here also that your book traces the history of what you just described, but also reflects on some common criticisms. Soccer ferments nationalism, serves right-wing powers, and fosters competitiveness. What are your thoughts on those issues?
Well, I think those are kind of common left-wing criticisms of, I think, sometimes competitive sports in general, but also soccer. And I think those are, you know, fair criticisms. I mean, it's obvious that, just to give you an example, you know, I was in Germany just 10 days ago, and I was there in Berlin on the day when Germany beat England 4-1, And honestly, it's just kind of, it's hard to watch what happens, you know, after that. Like, anyone who'd want to tell me that, well, you know, it's just a kind of whatever, you know, natural, friendly expression of, you know, people who are happy that their country's team wins a soccer game. I don't know. I mean, to me, especially in the German context, that those expressions are very frightening on many levels. And I mean, you know, sometimes that also becomes very concrete, where people of non-German origin get attacked, you know, as a mm-hmm. consequence of being so happy to be German. And that happens in other countries as well. So those kind of elements of, you know, competitive sports, especially soccer, which is, you know, such a big identity factor in a lot of countries, them fueling, like, nationalist sentiments is certainly true. The fact that and those sports with a strong focus on competitiveness, that doesn't necessarily contribute to a social climate of solidarity. It's also true the fact that's been documented in many ways that right-wing political powers, you know, use those events for their own purposes. However, I think there's also another side to it. Like, for example, the nationalism aspect I think is pretty interesting, because with all the nationalism that you see, it is also true that a lot of ties and friendships are being built, you know, between people from different countries and with very different backgrounds around soccer tournaments. So, I mean, if, for example, someone has ever been in a town where there was a World Cup or European Championship and you have fans, you know, from different countries, of course you see some kind of, you know, nasty incidents or confrontations, and sometimes, you know, that might be, even though that doesn't happen so much anymore, but actual, you know, physical confrontations. What you see much more is that, you know, people with different fan colors will sit around and table and, I don't know, drink and have a good time and bond, and then they sometimes, you know, visit each other or organize games of their local pub team against some other team in some other country. So there is definitely, I think, still a sense of those kind of events in soccer really uniting people. Or give you another example, like I traveled quite a lot. You can be pretty much in whatever kind of country you want to. You don't, you know, need to speak the language or whatever. If you see people playing soccer, mm-hmm. it's one of the best ways to make friends, basically, joining a pickup game, and it all works. It is, I mean, it's a bit of a cliche, but, you know, that phrase of soccer as an international language, I mean, that still exists. So, yeah, I think there is. And then again, you know, for the right-wing politicians who've used soccer, there have also been, as you mentioned, you know, you gave a good example, there have been, you know, left-wing individuals or even teams who, you know, who would use that platform to get other messages out. So I think it goes both ways. And what I'm trying with the book is just to show that other side that's more attractive, I guess, to radicals.
I'm speaking with Gabriel Kuhn. He's the author of Soccer Versus the State, Tackling Football and Radical Politics, which will be released soon by PM Press. And I have just a couple more questions for you. What do you make of situations like the effort of fans of Manchester United and Liverpool to build movements so that the fan base retakes ownership of the club from basically global finance capitalists who bought the club, and they unload debt on it, and, you know, just all becomes part of the crazy matrix of global finance?
I think those are very exciting. I mean, obviously, you know, even within those groups, there are different approaches. There are some who just want a little more influence on decisions of the club, so this would be kind of like a very reformist model. And there are some, I guess, who'd really like to take over the club as a sort of cooperative or whatnot, mm-hmm. But try to, you know, maintain the same kind of level, if that's possible, you know, of professionalism and whatnot. And you've also seen factions that have really kind of split, you know, from these clubs and claim to represent, you know, some kind of original, in that case, for example, Manchester United or Liverpool spirit or the original club, while, you know, what you see now, the big corporation thing, is just a sort of ripoff of what, you know, those clubs were about originally. Politically, you know, I guess you side with whatever faction suits you best. But, I mean, I think those are terribly exciting events, and that's obviously a fairly big part of the book as well. It's kind of, yeah, how do you, as a fan who's politically conscious and who is against, you know, these big corporative interests in soccer, how do you oppose that? The question that I find really interesting is that possible while at the same time, you know, maintaining the level of the game, I guess, which you don't have to, but I guess some people would like that, you know, so they would still, you know, want to have Beckhams and Rooneys in some sense, or Ronaldos, but just have more control of the clubs. I'm not sure, to be honest, if that works. But I find it terribly interesting, and I hope there are going to be all sorts of models of fan involvement in those clubs so that we'll see and learn how all that goes.
The 2010 World Cup, the numbers haven't come in yet, but from where I sit, it seems that it was the most successful World Cup in history in terms of global attention being paid to the World Cup, which would seem to be the prime measure by which these things are judged against each other. And it's taking place, unlike the 2006 World Cup, in the wake of the incredible financial crisis that occurred in 2007 and 2008. And I suppose what I want to ask you is, what was absent from this World Cup and what seems largely absent on the world stage is what was termed an anti-globalization movement, or a counter-globalization movement perhaps is better, from the late 90s into the early part of this past decade to sort of be prominent in the world. At least in the United States, that movement moved to the margins following September 11th. And I'm wondering if you look at like the critique of global capital that the counter-globalization movement has put forward, how would you see something like the 2010 World Cup taking place through that prism? It might be a vague question, but I suppose what I'm getting at is, you know, this is the event that more people in the world pay attention to than anything else in the world. The probably primary global political context is that of this sort of post-financial crisis that has occurred. So what do you make of that?
As you said, it's maybe a vague question. It touches on many, many issues. I would pick up two, maybe. I think what an event like the World Cup, or this specific World Cup, shows, or I guess reflects, is a little bit of something that has been discussed a lot in the context of the, you know, anti-globalization, ultra-globalization movement in general, namely that there are those kind of, you know, two parallel movements, I suppose, of globalization. And the World Cup is, in so far, I think, a good expression of that, as on the one hand, FIFA, if you will, represents globalization as at its worst. I mean, it's a very exclusive, very elitist, extremely powerful organization that is, you know, global and represents, if you will, global corporate interests at the same time. As I said before, I think what also does happen during events like the World Cup is that it actually does bring people together in a certain sense physically, because, you know, during that time, you know, there are people from all over the world in South Africa who, as I said before, you know, very often make connections on a grassroots level, if you will, that don't have anything to do with corporate interests. So I think that's very important. But then also generally, I mean, I think those kind of events that become common reference points for people, you know, all across the world, I think are important events to build, you know, relationships that go beyond national and cultural and other borders. Once again, let me pick up that traveling example again I used from before. I mean, it's not just that you can easily bond with people when you travel by joining pickup games. It's also very easy to bond if you just drop a few names like, you know, Messi or Casillas, or I don't know, some of those very famous players that pretty much everyone knows, like whether, you know, you're in Korea or in the Senegal, people will know those names, and it'll, you know, it'll allow you to start a conversation and share laughs and whatnot. And I think that level of internationalism, if you will, or globalization in that sense, definitely is expressed in the World Cup. So once again, it's a double-edged sword. But something definitely has to be done about FIFA. I mean, I can say that. I mean, the clubs are bad, and it's good that there are fan movements that try to change that. But something has to be done with respect to FIFA as well. I mean, that's almost an archaic institution in the way it's run and in the powers it holds.
You know, I've been asking a lot of the authors we've had on a final question. In many respects, you've answered it already, which is to even pull the lens back even one step further than asking about the financial crisis, which is, okay, it's 2010. It's this point in human history that we're all living in. Why is it that this soccer tournament is the most popular event in the world? And since you've come so close to answering that in many respects, maybe, you know, combine that a little bit with your experience as a soccer player, because one thing that many authors have touched upon is the joy that the game brings to people, and then you sort of mix it into the sort of global media simulation satellite effect that is what global culture is made of these days. So just your reflections on why it is that at this point in human history, perhaps this is the one unifying cultural event.
Well, to be honest, I think you've kind of taken taken my answer away with the way you phrased your question. I do think that it is, to put it simply, it is a combination of the fact that soccer you know, has been a very popular game for a long time, which, you know, has to do with the fact, as I said before, I think it's a very simple game, very simple rules, very easy to play. It spread fairly early worldwide, a lot, you know, related to colonialism, which is another whole aspect that we won't have time to touch on. But anyway, so it has this history, and it is, you know, also, it just, even though there are certain countries like the U.S. where other sports are more popular, overall it is definitely true that it is the most popular game worldwide. And then I think what has happened within the last 30, 40 years is just that it is, and that is, you know, by corporate or capitalist interest, but it has been turned into an extremely, well, just a great aspect of pop culture worldwide. And it's being exploited, if you will, in that sense, perfectly. And obviously, since pop culture is another phenomenon that is a global phenomenon these days and pretty much touches on almost every single human being. So that combination, that history of being a really popular, if you will, the people's game, together with this being exploited, if you will, as a pop cultural phenomenon by corporate interests, I think that's what turns the World Cup into such a spectacle.
Well, as much fun as people had this past month watching the World Cup, one can only imagine looking forward that hosting it in Brazil will no doubt create perhaps a sense of imbalance, and one of the tournament favorites will be hosting the tournament. But people, I can only imagine there'll be great sense of anticipation and anticipation of great joy with the tournament being held in 2014 in Brazil. In advance of that, we at the People's Game, we've been contacted by a group that is calling for a global one-month holiday in 2014, basically a global general strike, since so many people around the world were exhausting themselves so extremely this past month trying to combine all of their regular responsibilities with watching two, three, even four soccer matches per day. Your thought on such a call for a strike?
If it's going to turn into a longer general strike, I think it'd be wonderful to begin with. It sounds like a good idea. I mean, it depends obviously on how that strike's going to be conducted, but it could definitely be part of what I said before, of that kind of sort of grassroots internationalism or grassroots globalization of soccer. You know, strikes are always, I mean, strikes can come and go and not much happen, if you will, but they carry a lot of potential. So yeah, I don't know, you know, about this group or what the exact motivations are, but the bare facts sound exciting, I think. Yeah, there's potential in that.
Well, Gabriel Kuhn, it's great to have you on The People's Game. We look forward to getting your book when it's released by PM Press later this year. It's called Soccer Versus the State, Tackling Football and Radical Politics. Thank you so much for joining us on The People's Game.
Well, thanks so much.